You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster and all-round gastronaut. Now, ahead of the COP26 climate talks in Glasgow coming in November 2021, the UK has announced intentions to cut carbon emissions by 78% by 2035. In December 2020, a whole range of ambitious targets were set in the UK's sixth carbon budget. If we achieve it, we will be three quarters of the way to net zero by 2050. The carbon emission cuts are coming across many industries: aviation, shipping, construction. But we're going to look at just one aspect that's mentioned: reducing meat and dairy consumption by 20%. With me to discuss this are Chris Venables, Head of Politics from the Green Alliance. Hello, Chris.
Good morning. Hi.
And Dr. Michael Clark, Researcher, Nuffield Department of Population Health at the University of Oxford. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
It was great to have you both here. Now, just a couple of general things, first of all. Chris, reading the CCC's recommended pathway looks extraordinarily ambitious. I mean, almost naively so as I read through it. It's just so positive. It's so exciting. I read it and go, that's fantastic. Do you think it's really feasible to reduce our carbon emissions by 78% by 2035 or to net zero by 2050?
Yes. Resoundingly so. I mean, I guess one of the amazing things that we have here in the UK is the Committee on Climate Change. It sounds quite boring, but it really isn't, because it's this group of people who get to sit down and think about how we do this mammoth task. And it is a mammoth task, and I agree with you on that. But they get to talk to experts, academics, people doing the work, and they come up with a really credible, evidence-based way of saying, there's a really ambitious target, but here's how we get there. And so I read that and I trust in their kind of million spreadsheets and long reports, and I think, yes, we can absolutely do it. And yeah, so yes is the answer to that question, kind of very simply.
Okay, well, that's really exciting. That's an exciting start. And we'll get to the nuts and bolts of it in a minute, which might get a little bit trickier. now, Mike, the Prime Minister recently announced revision of targets up to 78%. Now, is this the mark of a Prime Minister who's simply making a jolly announcement he won't have to see through? Or is there the political will and funding and regulation to back it up? I mean, you know, we know that it's timely that there was a new coal mine just given the go ahead and the scrapping of the Green Homes grant. Is it just a jolly idea, or do you think we can genuinely do it?
Yeah, so I agree with Chris on this. I definitely think we can do this. That being said, we really need to start today if we actually are serious about meeting that 78% reduction target. The one thing that's going to be really important to kind of balance is the fact that we're facing climate targets, but also need to keep essentially economic systems and cultural values in the back of our mind. And whoever's in charge of balancing those is in a position I do not personally envy too much.
Well, that's, I guess, and that brings us on to this podcast. Now, we're very much aimed at people interested in the business of food. Now, cutting meat and dairy consumption by a fifth, 20%, probably is an exciting idea, but terrifies a lot of people in farming and in food. Do you think that 20%, Chris, is 20% the right amount? Is this a considered idea, or have they just thrown this out there as a dream?
Well, I think the starting point for all of this, in my mind, is that, you know, based upon, you know, the work of world scientists in October 2018, if we want to meet the 1.5 degree goal, we have to reduce emissions across the global economy by half by 2030. And like that's your kind of starting point. Like, and that isn't a kind of like, oh, you know, that would be nice. It's a really serious thing, you know. And like, if you get into, as I do, if you kind of read about the impacts of climate change every day, it's not really a pretty picture. It's quite depressing, it's sad, and it's like, and so it really motivates you to kind of think what would be possible. So just to turn to the 20% piece, I think that's perfectly possible. I mean, I think it's also worth saying that agricultural emissions in the UK are kind of one of the sectors that has kind of crept up as others have crept down. And so it's one of those kind of sectors that we really need to kind of turn a laser focus to and work out at at quite a systemic level, how we change things. And I don't think that's about saying to anyone, oh, you're wrong, don't eat meat. You know, that's about saying kind of what's going on with our supermarkets, kind of what's, you know, how can we support farmers to do stuff differently? How can we educate people to understand about the food system and kind of make the changes in a way that feels like it could be fun and good. And I can say a bit about my own personal story on that as well. You know, so, yeah.
I bet you could. Yeah, hold on with that. So, but first of all, so what's interesting is I think you touched on a couple of things here. There are two different things. There are the production methods. There is agriculture and its emissions and the potential ability to cut those emissions. And then there's consumption on the other side. So there are two, I mean, there are lots of different issues to this, but those are two major factors. Do you think there is potential in cutting carbon emissions, but to some extent not cutting 20% of the production of meat and dairy?
Well, I look to Mike as I think the expert on this, but my strong understanding is that you can't. You're like, you really have to reduce how much high carbon, you know, food products we're eating across the board. That said, we also know, you know, a third of food across the globe is wasted between kind of farm and fork. So there's all kinds of ways of reducing our impact. But as part of that quite big package of things, you have to look at meat and dairy and you have to look at how much we're eating. And I love a bacon sandwich as much as anyone, but you know, I can't have one every day, or you know, like, you know, there's things we're going to have to look at. We do have to reduce what we're eating, but I don't think it's this kind of big, drastic, no me anymore kind of thing. It's just kind of slight shift. Yeah.
Okay, so Mike, what's your opinion on this? I mean, you know, we could be feeding cattle, insects, and things like that in order to reduce the greenhouse gas embedded emissions. But do you think it really also needs to come down to consumption?
Yes, absolutely. So I'll start with a broader perspective, real quick. So if you look at a global scale, so Chris was mentioning this very briefly, but if you look at a global scale right now, agriculture and food production systems emit about a third of global greenhouse gas emissions. And so I think it's important to iterate that, because we don't, most individual society perspective, when we think about climate change, we think about fossil fuels. But if you look at agriculture, that's a third of the driver behind climate change at a global perspective. And if you narrow down into livestock, so meat and dairy, that accounts for about anywhere between a third to a half of agricultural emissions. So if you stick that back into that global perspective, producing animals for either meat or dairy accounts for about somewhere between 10 to 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And so that kind of brings us to the question that you're asking, where if we reduce that chunk by 20%, what does that mean in the context of these climate targets? And so I'm very much in the mindset that it's kind of two different things. So if we're talking about places like the UK, where there's a general history of overconsumption, both in terms of just food in general, but also meat and dairy in specific, is that places like that are going to need to reduce consumption of meat and dairy, probably reduce consumption of other things too. I'll get back to that in a second, and need to do that relatively rapidly. So most indications from papers, from research in the last 2 to 3 years indicate that in countries like the UK, consumption of red meat, so pork and beef and mutton and goat, and the consumption of poultry collectively need to reduce probably about 75% if we're actually serious to meet these climate targets. And so from that perspective, 20% reduction in meat and dairy is a start, but it isn't going to get us to where we need to be. The complicated aspect of this is that it's also going to be very context specific. And so if you go to a different country that may not have as much access to meat, have a lot of food insecurity, and you go to people within that country and say, hey, look, you need to reduce your meat consumption, when they already don't get enough food, that isn't really something that you want to be doing. It's not fair. It's not equitable. It's not just. It very well could be killing people if you communicate it that way. And so in places like the UK, a 20% reduction isn't going to be anywhere close to enough. But in places where underconsumption is prevalent, eating more is probably better for the people. And even if it may not be quite ideal in the climate perspective. We do need to focus on the people before we start targeting these environmental problems that we're facing.
Now, obviously, the farming industry, agriculture, and a lot of the food industry would say, well, what you're dealing with here is not just a target, but also about culture, economics, lifestyle, and that will, you know, that will be impacted by all of these things. Should people just brace themselves and take what's coming to them, or is there a way to deal with this that is constructive?
That's a fantastic question. I'll take it then. Yeah. So I think one of my friends, Justin Zella, has said this a few times, and I think it's kind of, we're at the point where we need to think about what we're willing to give up. And so if we are serious about meeting either climate target or biodiversity targets or water scarcity targets, we really need to think about what are we willing to give up to meet that. And so right now, in the context of what we're just talking about, are we willing to give up meat and dairy, maybe give up some other foods or reduce consumption to meet those targets? If we don't reduce meat and dairy, it means we have to do something else more ambitiously. But it's kind of, it's going to be different by person, it's going to be different by country, by, again, contexts. But we have to think, we really do need to think about what are we actually willing to do to meet these targets on both an individual level and a society-wide level.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I mean, I suppose I spend a lot of my time working at the political level. So you know, spend a lot of time with MPs, to ministers, to, you know, at the government. And I think, you know, we're at quite an exciting point in the UK in that regard, because we left the EU, because we are kind of in the process of redesigning our agricultural support payments. Yeah, you know, there is quite a big potential to look, you know, like 10, 15 years ahead and just think about how we do that. So I don't think it has to be this big kind of like U-turn or big kind of, you know, shift to the, you know, kind of stop and drive into direction. But I think there are some really good plans in place to start, you know, like changing how we spend that kind of £3 billion every year, you know, of taxpayers' money at supporting, you know, kind of our farms across the UK. And you'll know better than me probably, but you know, that there's all kinds of new schemes that are being set up just to kind of shift how those payments work. And so I think it's as much about kind of, and I think that's the beauty of the targets in a way, is that, you know, 2030 is kind of long enough away that you can start to think, well, how do we get there? And what do we do, you know, and so I think, so that feels quite exciting to me. And I think it's on all of us to change what we do individually, but also just to kind of ask up, you know, and you know, that the government is in a position of power to really shift at those things in a way that's happened in the electricity system. You know, we've basically decarbonized our electricity system, you know, through kicking coal off the electricity grid. If you ask those people, yeah, they don't have a clue that's happened. These ways of kind of, you know, changing the structures of our economy without being really disruptive.
That's right. So a target has to happen, otherwise we ain't going to get anywhere right. near it. Now, this is an analogous situation. It's not exactly the same as the UK, but I filmed with the Inuit in northern Canada, where their societal system changed pretty fundamentally when they weren't allowed to sell meat from large, you know, sea mammals that they collected. And also they had a big change where basically healthcare came in where it hadn't been before. Now, these things should have been really positive. They weren't. They destroyed Inuit culture, and all of the traditional knowledge and forms of behavior that they had were suddenly irrelevant. Now, it wasn't just a case of, wait, we've got free healthcare, we've got unemployment support. It was a fundamental societal problem that happened. So the big thing is, what needs to be put in place to be able to mitigate the impacts of reducing meat and dairy consumption by 20%? Are we talking taxes to make it happen? Are we calling for tax breaks or subsidies on vegan food? Are we after regulation and laws, technology, or do we need to guilt trip people in order to change things? What are the tools that are going to be available to really help this happen in a constructive way? Chris, what do you think?
It's a really good question, and I think I just go back to where I said before, you know, that, you know, I I suspect most people, I don't know, there's no reason why you would, that, you know, our, you know, our farms, our food industry is massively subsidized, you know, by government funds, and we can change how those funds are used, and we are changing how those funds are used. And if you look now at the kind of environmental land management schemes, or even the sustainable farm incentive, which is kind of new, you know, way of funding farms, the kind of slight tweaks, so that the way that we use land is, you know, shift over time to become more sustainable. And I think that's probably the primary way that we do this. And, you know, it's 3 billion in the UK, you know, 3 billion pounds, it's 400 billion US dollars across the world. And so there's some pretty big kind of systemic stuff that we can do there. And just on the culture, I think it's also, I mean, this is just kind of my take, right? Like, I think my grandparents, kind of, they grew up in the north of England. So, you know, like, I used to spend a lot of time there at the Lake District. And I don't feel that our food culture now, like kind of supermarket food culture, is something that they would strongly identify with. Like, I don't think it's kind of like necessarily like deeply rooted in like, or you know, has a long history in like, in British life. Like, I think there's ways that we can kind of reconnect with food that could be like, you know, really powerful and really positive for like our culture. And I think that could really work for like a lot of people. But I also think, as you say, we also have this risk, you know, particularly in the UK as well, you know, where the government says, well, look, it's 3 billion quid, and, you know, we're in an economic crisis, so, you know, scrap it. And that cannot happen. Like, we have to support farmers, we have to support kind of rural communities to a fair and just transition. And I'd really hope, I really hope that we can do that. Like, well, we have to do it. So yeah.
Okay, so Mike, Chris is pretty positive about this, but change can be exciting. It sounds exciting to me, but it hurts. It hurts for a lot of people. It hurts the food industry in its pocket. Do you think everyone should just become vegan, or is there a way to do this that is positive?
That's also a fantastic question. I'm going to follow on from Chris before answering the question about vegan, about everybody becoming vegan. The example that you mentioned about Inuit or coal mining before is really stereotypical of kind of how not all policy, but I'd say policy is often implemented, where it's top down with the perspective of we know better than you, and even further than that, our values are better than yours, which absolutely is not the case. And again, going back to what I was saying before, is that you really need to understand the values that different people have before implementing things that might affect them. Because without those people both being supportive of what you're trying to do, but also being benefited from what you're trying to do, just any legislation, any environmental target, any shift that you're trying to implement just isn't going to work. In terms of the question that you just asked, no, I do not think everybody should be vegan. And I mean, there are a lot of different reasons for that.
Are you a vegan? Mike?
I am not. No,
just out of interest. I'm not accusing anything.
No, fair enough. I really love my cheese.
Chris already mentioned the bacon, so you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love my cheese, and I have fish and chips about once a year. But no, so I don't think everybody should become vegan. And a few reasons for that: again, cultural values, social norms, economic values too. In places, livestock production is super important for society, for well-being, so on. And even if it's not important for those, it may be very important culturally.
Yeah.
And so just saying nobody can eat meat, which is going to affect people like us, but also going to affect the people that are producing that meat. And that second part, I think, is a little bit harder to understand and probably more important to understand. And so, yeah, just we need to be a little bit maybe more aware or more cognizant or be better at recognizing how removing something entirely, so meat, dairy, eggs in this case, might negatively impact certain populations.
Yeah.
And so from my personal perspective, yes, it might be easy for one individual, for two individuals, for five individuals to become vegan. But when you start doing that at system-wide scale, what are those knock-on impacts going to be?
Yeah.
And who's going to bear the consequences of those?
Well, that's right. Now, I think that people in the UK are, certainly the vegan movement has been very successful. A lot of people are becoming flexitarians. I think products in shops shout their moral perspective very, very well these days. But I think a lot more probably needs to be done. Now, government says it wants to maintain people's freedom of choice. So how do we convince people to eat less meat and dairy? Guilt tripping is a very negative sounding phrase, but that's what we need to do. We need to push the moral perspective on this, don't we? How do we convince people to eat less meat and dairy? Because it tastes so good. I mean, it really does. Chris, what do you think?
Well, I worked for the Green Party for 3 years in Parliament, and there was an amazing canteen in Parliament, and every Friday I would treat myself to a bacon and sausage wrap with black pudding. I'd stroll into the Green Party office, and I'd always feel a little bit like, I don't know if I should really be doing this. And I think that kind of embodies like a bit like the tension that exists, which is that people really want, I think, like a very deep level to do the right thing with what they eat. But like the system's like a little bit set up to make it really hard to do that. So I think awareness is like a really big part of it. When I think about a veganism, I kind of get this image. I think it was a protest where, I think it was a climate protest, and the vegans were on block dressed in purple, there's thousands of them, and they just kind of walked around shouting, "Go vegan!" And I remember, and I'm someone who's thought about this stuff a lot, being like, guys, I'm not sure that's going to cut it. Like, I think maybe we need to like have a conversation about food and like what people do. So I like that said, and my girlfriend's a vegan, and she's the most amazing cook, and I just love it because I get to eat so much amazing food that I would never eat because I'd go down the chippy, or I'd kind of, you know, just eat something really simple. So I think there's something around kind of finding like really good, kind of plant-based food. And I think that's kind of on the up because it is bloody gorgeous. And then, you know, just that kind of understanding that we can eat meat, that we should eat meat, but we just need to eat a bit less of it, and we need to eat it better. And I think people understand that. I just think it's kind of just finding ways that make it cost effective to do so, and that's the really tricky part.
It is a bit more expensive at the moment, I would say, to be vegan and to eat really well. I mean, you can eat badly and eat carrots and beans all day, but to eat really well is a bit tricky. But I think as you say, the food industry is benefiting from this. You know, there are loads of products out there. The retailers are throwing, having a lot of fun, buying up vegan companies and using them to make their own products. Mike, do you think that we need to push it a bit further, though? You know, Where we procure food on a grand scale, schools, hospitals, prisons, should we start with things like that and change procurement policies there? Will that help, or will it nudge things in the right way?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it depends on kind of what scale you're looking at. So if we're just saying, let's look at a single school and we source food and drinks from that school from more sustainable producers, that's going to reduce the impacts of that school. But if you take a wider scale and say, okay, now this school is sourcing from more sustainable producers, that means somebody else has to source from the less sustainable producers now. And so what that means is that sourcing is going to matter for at smaller scales, but from a wider system perspective, you really need to be able to figure out to say, how can we get the least sustainable producers or all producers in general just to shift towards lower impact systems? So yes, it kind of matters, but from a broader perspective, it may not be the most important thing. The one thing I'd also like to raise, kind of following on from what Chris said, is the government has said multiple times that they don't want to try to restrict choice in terms of food or beverages or so on. But I also think it's really important to recognize that they already have a lot of policies in terms of restricting our choice in terms of food and beverages. And so if you think about procurement policies for school meals, there are stringent regulations on what can be served. If you think about sugar levies on sugar-sweetened beverages, salt taxes that are potentially going to be implemented soon, regulations in London on advertising to kids within, I think, 500 meters of primary schools. And so, like, I understand that government may not want to restrict choice from how people may act and behave around food and their decision making, but they already do it in some quite powerful ways.
So, and Chris, what tools do you think we should use to start changing people's attitudes? You know, we were talking about schools. You know, rather than just sort of not supplying meat, do we need to start looking at changing kids' attitudes to their food, or are there different methods that we should use?
So yeah, you know, just building on Mike said as well. I think you know, it's such a, it is a really kind of complicated thing, and you've got that really kind of, you know, systemic stuff, as I was saying, you know, the kind of really big policy levers, you know, that the government has to kind of slowly over time shift stuff. I think that public awareness raising is probably a really important part of that. And I think, you know, just going back to what we're saying about, you know, kind of farming and rural life as well, like farmers, I think, have to be like quite central to that. Like, I don't think you can have that conversation, you know, devoid of a, you know, kind of outside of a conversation around how you changed farming and like how you change, as you say, those quite kind of deeply embedded ideas about kind of rural life and like where our food comes from. So, but yeah, I think if you know, as Mike said, if you look at, you know, kind of smoking or you know, or any kind of major shift, you know, cultural shift, you know, that have happened, and you know, it feels like we're in a time of big shifts, then you know, a big part of that, you know, has to be a group of leaders, whether it's in the political or the cultural, being really clear about the direction of travel, and kind of, you know, I guess, you know, stigmatizing is part of that, but I think we should be wary about, you know, creating a very kind of polarized debate. I think, yeah, finding ways to, you know, showcase like stories of farmers whom I'm sure we all know, you know, like it's kind of inspiring to see this kind of new movement of farmers kind of doing it differently, you know, often at scale now. It's not just someone in their back garden, it's like at scale, you know, changing how we farm. It's like super amazing. And so, yeah, so I think, yeah, so I think it's all of that. And I think young people, you know, not to put it all on them, but, you know, they have really brought this issue to the fore over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. I'm not sure, you know, we would have got the emissions reduction target without young people saying, oi, are you guys, you know, like, what's going on? What are you doing? So I think they would understand the need for some, you know, quite big shifts.
And we've had some really extraordinary progressive farmers on this show talking about their absolute commitment and love, actually, of sustainability and you know, make, you know, they're thinking about their farms in 20, 50 years' time, I guess. But then I'm also aware that there are people who go fox hunting, who, you know, to me, fox hunting seems like the most bizarre idea on the planet, but there are these people that are so committed. They say it's part of the fabric of our culture, and I'm just aware that it's very difficult to make these changes. Now, Mike, if we don't make these changes, if we don't reduce meat and dairy consumption by 20%, what impact will this have on the climate? Can you unpack some figures on that for me?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give a very absurd example to kind of illustrate the magnitude of the issue that we're facing. So right now, let's assume just somehow magically we can wave our wand and reduce all emissions from everything that is not from the food system. So it doesn't mean that we're not driving cars, but it means those cars are either electric powered, they're from biodiesel, all transportation, so on, is net zero fossil fuel emissions. So what that means is that only leaves us with emissions from the food system. And so if we keep consuming the way that we are and the way that we have been for about the past 30 or 35 years and don't change anything about food systems, so how it's consumed, how it's produced, so on, we're going to miss the 1.5C climate target within about 30 to 45 years. And so again, this is only one accounting for emissions from food systems. And so the second you add back in emissions from transportation, from industry, so on, it becomes even more, I wouldn't say problematic, but the issue becomes a lot larger. And so bringing it back to your question is that we know that, or there's a very good indication that if we don't change anything about food systems, we're going to miss these climate targets within a few decades, which means if we don't reduce meat and dairy by 20%, we're going to miss the climate targets within a few decades. Following on from that a little bit farther is the same analyses that take that framing of saying, let's only assume greenhouse gas emissions are only coming from the food system, is that those analyses have also indicated that on a global scale, meat and dairy would probably have to reduce by about 60 to 80% to meet the climate targets. So again, from following on from what I was saying before, it's not only is a 20% reduction enough, but it's 20% reduction in meat and dairy, even when there are no emissions from anything but food, is not going to be enough.
Okay, so just one last but kind of big question, I guess, to ask to both of you. Are we moving fast enough on this? How do we actually make a change? Now, we've been talking in conceptual terms. We've been talking hypothetical ideas, targets and committees. But what can we actually do? Can you give me some specific examples, whether that's people doing things at home, whether it's farmers changing how they farm, or is it just going vegan? Mike, give us some real examples of change that you think can happen pretty quickly. You know, the first things, the low-hanging fruit. What do you want to see happen right now?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things. So first and foremost, from a consumer perspective, we can try to gradually shift away from meat and dairy, and specifically beef. From more of a policy and legislation perspective, there's a lot that we can do. It's, as Chris mentioned before, it could be maybe reshifting agricultural subsidies to promote healthier and more nutritious and more sustainable products. It could be communication, it could be education, it could be things like mandating eco labels on the front of package. So we already have nutrition labels. If we're serious about meeting climate targets, maybe having eco labels can be effective.
I've been thinking a lot about this idea, eco labels. So literally a traffic light system of the emissions involved. You know, I guess it gets a little bit difficult to pin down when you're talking about animal welfare concerns, but you know, you can quantify a whole bunch of different things around it, which I think this is a really good idea. Is there much will to put something this into place, do you think?
Yeah, so the government of France actually just mentioned that they're going to do this on a national scale. And so, yeah, I mean, granted, France is definitely not the UK in terms of policy circles, obviously, but yeah, I mean, a lot of people do want this. And even if it isn't eco-labels, just being able to have that product-specific environmental information could be super powerful, both in terms of decision making, but also just in terms of transparency in food systems.
I think the food industry is less keen than I am on the idea of it, but I think it could be really useful. Okay, Chris, what low hanging fruit? What do we need to do to start making a change right now?
Not to be super boring, as a person who spends a lot of their time thinking about government policy, but the really simple thing to do is just create a bloody great plan for how you help farmers do farming better, and then just support them to do it through skills training, whatever. It's just like, that's what we should be doing. like it's not that complicated. Like, in my head I'm just like, you know, like 70% of UK land is used for farming. It needs to be done differently, and we need to shift a little bit, you know, away from meat and dairy. Okay, it gets really complicated, whatever, but like, at a basic level, the political will has to be there. So if I was someone listening to this podcast, I just think, well, my MP, you know, and the people who represent me should be tackling this problem for me. This is not something that I can do on my own, and that's what they're there to do. That's their job, basically. So, you know, and we kind of know how to do it, because there's people like Mike, and there's all kinds of people who kind of have a really good sense of, you know, how the changes. I think that's if I could wave my magic wand, then that's what I would do.
Well, Dr. Mike Clark and Chris Venables, thank you so much for filling us in about the details of these incredibly important issues. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts, in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from indulgence to controlling our appetite. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.